You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The order from health officials to restaurants, no more outdoor dining for at least 3 weeks or until the coronavirus surge goes down. Starting at 10 o'clock Wednesday night, eateries all over LA County will have to go back to offering takeout and delivery only. That includes, not coincidentally, Thanksgiving. LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer says the measures are intended to limit mixing in settings where people are not wearing masks and can spread the virus. But the move is likely to hit a lot of local restaurants hard. Here's Jot Condi, who heads up the California Restaurant Association.
For the restaurants that are still around, and there's the numbers of restaurant closures are mounting by the day, outdoor dining and sidewalks and parking lots is the only way for them to, you know, stay afloat.
Now, this follows last week's countywide order that required restaurants offering outdoor dining to reduce their capacity by 50%.
At least in a restaurant where, you know, you're distanced, you have a staff who are constantly assuring that guests are adhering to the protocols, wearing the mask when you need to wear the mask, you know, social distancing. If you have to go to the restroom, put the mask on. So it's a safer environment to eat in a restaurant than it is in your friend's living room.
But that raises some questions. How safe is it really to eat outside with your friends? And why do people feel like dining out is a risk that they can take during a pandemic that's killed going on 7,500 people in LA County alone? Paula Cannon is professor of microbiology and immunology over at the Keck School of Medicine at USC. Professor, welcome back.
Hello, Steve.
Benjamin Seitz is a doctoral student in psychology across town at UCLA, and he's been researching the behavioral effects of COVID-19. Benjamin, welcome to you.
Happy to be here.
Paula, we're talking about restaurants, obviously, that are having to close their dining, their outdoor patio dining, or the parklets that you see, or, you know, people taking extraordinary steps at these restaurants to make sure that they can salvage whatever business they can. I mean, what do you tell a restaurant owner who's asking, you know, why are you targeting us? I mean, is this a big way of getting COVID?
Yeah. So again, the unfortunate truth is that yes, the answer to that is yes. There's a study actually that just came out of Stanford, there you go, another California university, from the computer scientists, and they really tracked where people go by tracking their cell phones. And then they correlated that with, you know, the sort of cases that happened at the local level. And they really concluded that something like 75% of all infections are happening in what they call these super spreader sites, which are restaurants, coffee bars, gyms, and places of worship. So it's unfortunate, but it's actually true that restaurants and coffee bars are spreading this virus right now.
Benjamin, I know a lot of folks are either completely oblivious to what's going on, or they're constantly checking the daily rates of infection. I mean, this is me, by the way, the positivity rates yeah. and the hospitalization rates. I mean, why are people psychologically all over the place? Is there a lot of denial here? Is there a lot of, you know, what I can't see or what I don't pay attention to can't scare me?
Yeah, well, I think what we have here is that we didn't evolve to be accurate surveyors of our world. We evolved to maintain connections within our group. And so we're not really good at accurately looking at the data. We practice things like confirmation bias, and we weight our own experiences much more than we actually objectively look at data. And so I think that's why you can have something where 250,000 people have died. And yet, if you think those 250,000 people, let's say they're related to 100 individuals, be they neighbors or coworkers or friends or family, that only leaves 25 million people that actually know someone who's died from COVID. And so again, because we weight our own experiences, we have the vast majority of people who don't know anyone who's died of COVID. And so they're not taking this seriously, even though that number, 250,000, is astronomically high.
Paula, I guess the question for you is, again, looking in the fact that I look at all these numbers all the time, the positivity rates for sure, the hospitalization rates. I mean, these are things that we pay attention as journalists. How do you interpret these numbers? I mean, like how can you look at all this statistical data and distill it down so that folks can understand why you're still quarantining, why you're still at home, why, you know, things don't appear to be getting better. They appear to be getting worse.
Yeah, it's actually really hard. I mean, I can just throw out numbers. And as Ben said, they kind of, there's like a numbing effect and people don't really know what to do with that information. I think what I say to people instead is, you know, look at the curves, look at the graphs of how the cases have changed throughout the year. You know, we had this big peak in the summer in Southern California in July, and we got it under control and it kind of came down again. The uptick we're seeing now, though, we've reached and exceeded the rates that we hit in the summer, and the curve is just going straight up. So it's really scary to me, because unless we significantly change our behavior, there's nothing else that's going to stop those numbers climbing. So I'm hoping that the new restrictions that are now being imposed from Wednesday night are going to go some way, hopefully a long way, to kind of getting those numbers under control again.
If you have a patient in front of you and you're like, hey, I really need to be blunt with you, this is what I got to tell you that we got to do for the coming months or whatever to get this under control. I mean, what do you say? How do you say it like you're talking to a fourth grader?
Oh, Lordy.
Yeah, I mean, well, because all of this is very human, right? I mean, we're humans,
we want to be
coddled, right? We want to be.
Well, we don't want to be told bad news.
Yeah. We want to be comforted. So, I mean, yeah, we don't want to be told bad news.
Yeah, and I think it's just that it's going on so long, and people are saying, "Hey, well, wait a minute, I did that. I did that back in May and June and July, and I gave up my 4th of July party for you, and I gave up, you know, this other celebration. So, either it's not working, or I've had enough." And then I think this idea that we're now hearing that other people aren't obeying the rules. You have people who don't even wear masks. I don't know what's wrong with them. And so it's hard, I think, to continuously have this message and motivate people to do their part when you see other people are not doing it. But Ben's the psychologist here. He'll probably have a better insight into what's going on in people's minds than me about that.
I think you're exactly right, Paula. I also just think in this country, we really value our individualism. And so there's this continuum called the tight-loose continuum that was developed by a psychologist at University of Maryland, Michelle Gelfand. And so the U.S., we're a very loose culture. We value individualism. And that's why we're so creative and can come up with, great innovations. But that also means that we don't have strict social norms. And that's really not helping us during a pandemic where we need to be rule followers. We need to shun people who are breaking the rules. And countries that are on this other side of the spectrum, they're tighter. Countries like Japan and Singapore and Germany, those countries that have tight norms are doing really well right now because they can come together as a collective society and rally behind a common cause. And we're just not very good in this country at valuing that.
Let's jump back to the numbers, Paula, because there's a lot of information that we are not getting from the numbers, right? I mean, like, for example, who are the folks who are testing positive? Do we have those kinds of details? So you can correlate, what kind of person you are or what kind of risks you're taking to whether or not you actually get this virus.
Sure. Well, not to be judgy, but the numbers are...
Yeah,
really
nobody wants a lecture, remember.
I know, but I am a mother. So it's the 18 to 39-year-olds, especially the 18 to 29-year-olds, where most of the cases are. And that kind of makes sense. That they're the people who are out more. And I'm not even going to say they're out partying more. They're out working more as well. There's a lot more of those people in sort of... kind of frontline and lower paid jobs and the gig economy. In addition, we are still seeing disproportionate impact in our communities of color, especially in Latinos, 3 times as likely to be infected as the white population. And again, it probably reflects the types of jobs and the sort of living conditions in, multi-generational households and things like that. So nothing's changing in LA County. It's still kind of peaking in these same groups. And I think what's difficult, Steve, is that especially with younger people, this is also the group that, as well as having higher infection rates, are also more likely to have asymptomatic or less severe infections and, can be spreading the disease and not even know that they're infected. So that also creates an extra complication. This virus has really got some kind of tricks up its sleeve, and that's one of its best tricks, I think, that asymptomatic spread.
And so this is about messaging to those 18 to 39-year-olds, right?
Yeah. And you're really saying to them, you know, do this, not for you personally, maybe. You probably, you know, even if you get COVID, are not going to have a really bad outcome. But by this behavior, if you don't change your behavior, you are not contributing to keeping everybody else safe and getting our, you know, our restaurants back open again. So I think kind of appealing to people's, you know, sense of being part of something bigger, that they're doing this for their friends, their family, and also the broader community and their favorite restaurant. You know, that's the message I try to say, but I don't know if it's working anymore.
But again, getting back to what you said, Benjamin, where we have this individualism, right? And if you don't know, if 25 million people, you know somebody who has gotten COVID or who, sadly, awful, has died from COVID, right? But that means another 300 million people across the country don't know somebody, and you have this individualism. How do you penetrate that message to make sure that people really understand what's going on?
Yeah. I think that's, you know, when it comes to inferring causality, we rely so much on our visual system. We need to see that X causes Y to really make that inference. And of course, with a virus, we can't see it. And so it's just sort of hard for our species to wrap our heads around. We do have this common threat that should be bringing us all together and that we can rally behind. But because we can't see it, it's hard to really, like you said, get that messaging across to people. With that said, though, we know that this isn't the first virus that we've had to face as a species. We have a whole evolved psychology to help us avoid things that make us sick. And we know that there's ways to activate that psychology. So the whole reason we have a disgust system is really to avoid things that could be pathogens. And so, again, this sort of points back to the fact that numbers and statistics won't elicit disgust, but we know images and stories will. And so something that we could use in our toolbox is sort of these disgusting images and stories. Something like that might make people more fearful and could prompt more health-related actions. It's at least something to consider to use in our toolbox.
And so I guess the challenge, Paula, is to break through these walls that we've, you know, put up between each other. And you're a virologist. You're somebody who deals with patients and people who, certainly not physically anymore, but certainly people who have a fear or perhaps have a laissez-faire attitude to all of this. How do you make sure that it resonates with them in any category?
Yeah, and again, you know, I find disgust hard to convey to people, although I think we all have disgust when we see, you know, those pictures of, you know, refrigerated morgue trucks, you know, in El Paso now. What I try to do instead is appeal to, you know, people's better natures. And I try to talk in positive terms, in terms of what you can do. I say, hey, the good news is, you know, science has actually figured out that because of the way this virus is spread, wearing a mask is pretty darn effective at both protecting yourself and stopping you infecting other people. Isn't that amazing? Thank God we don't have to wear gas masks. We can just put one of those cute little, you know, cotton masks on, or one that we've made ourselves. You know, what's your favorite mask? You know, what does it say on it? So I try to use, you know, examples like that. And also, you know, I say to people, there is light at the end of the tunnel. We've had great news in the last couple of weeks about three different vaccines. We're going to have vaccines. They're going to be available. Can we just hang on until we get those vaccines? And Steve, don't even get me started on what I say to people who tell me they're not going to get vaccinated, because that's a conversation for the new year.
Yeah, well, let's save that for 2021, shall we? Because there's so much to talk about. We have the holidays coming up, Thanksgiving this Thursday, Christmas, you know, Hanukkah coming up in December. And it's like, you've got to weigh these options and be like, hey, there's a big risk when you're gathering people, especially people from different households. And I know there's so much happening. What is your advice to people who are thinking about those things right now, Paula?
So, and again, I frame it in terms of, not so much risk to yourself as risk to your loved ones. Early on in this pandemic, when I was speaking to my children, I would sort of say things like, you know, if you get COVID, whatever, you know, I'll give you Tylenol. But can you imagine how you would feel if you give COVID to your father or to me, or if you give COVID to somebody else and then you have to live with the consequences of that? Maybe we get seriously ill. Maybe something worse happens. How would you feel about that? And I found with my own kids that framing it that way, you know, having them think about a future you know, post-COVID, where they are looking back at their actions now and feeling remorse and guilt about that, that actually resonated with them. And maybe that speaks to what Ben was talking about our need to kind of be able to find ways to visualize things.
I want to thank you both, obviously. Benjamin Seitz, a doctoral student in psychology over at UCLA. Paula Cannon, professor of microbiology and immunology over at the Keck School at USC, whom, by the way, we have on speed dial. To both of you, thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, as we talked about, how you look at the pandemic depends upon a lot of factors, but politics definitely factors into it. There are those who believe it is absolutely the government's responsibility to keep people safe. And then there are folks who are adamant about not having their freedoms infringed upon.
Patriots are uniting, and we're going to stand and we're going to fight for our rights. We are Americans, and they will never take our rights away.
That's a protest against the state of California's 10 p.m. curfew that took place over the weekend in Huntington Beach. So the question is, who gets to decide when it's okay to infringe on individual rights and when it isn't? And what are some of the ways that the government is allowed to restrict freedoms? Erwin Chemerinsky is a professor and dean of the law school at UC Berkeley. He's an expert on constitutional law, and he's here with us right now. Welcome, sir.
Always great to talk with you.
America is founded on the idea of individual liberty, and a lot of Americans, you just heard the protesters down in Orange County over the weekend, bristle at the idea of government telling them that they have to wear a mask or that they have to stay home or they can't sit and eat at a restaurant. Are there provisions in the Constitution that allow for government to restrict individual freedoms in that kind of way?
Yes. No liberty or freedom is absolute. There's a famous adage that my freedom to swing my fist stops at somebody else's nose. The Supreme Court has been clear that the government has broad latitude to take the actions that are necessary to stop the spread of a communicable disease.
So this is a public health issue, right? Like, I can go out, I may have this disease, this virus, and that virus therefore can be transmitted to you. And so another person is in danger if I do that.
That's exactly why the government can take actions to stop the spread of communicable disease. In the late 18th century, early in the country, people were quarantined to stop the spread of yellow fever, and the court said that was fine. If courts want to order people to shelter in place or wear masks, it will be upheld. So long as the government is acting reasonably, it can restrict liberty to protect people's health.
All right, so going back to the yellow fever days then, were there protests in parts of the country when there were shutdowns and public health officials were trying to stop the spread of that disease?
I don't think there were protests at that time, but during the Spanish flu, when there were shutdowns, there were protests against them. But the courts consistently sided with the government. When it's a communicable disease, it's not just about a person hurting himself or herself.
All right, so folks gathered in Huntington Beach to protest the curfew. We saw many protests earlier in the summer, thousands of people, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people taking to the street. What do you do in a situation like that when you're protesting something that you feel strongly about in a pandemic because you're also doing something that is dangerous to other people?
If the government wanted to, it could stop people from gathering together to protest in the midst of the pandemic. Now, in reality, what the government has done is not enforce its restrictions so as to allow the protests to go on. But people who go to protest need to know that if they're within close proximity to others, they risk the transmission of a very serious communicable disease.
Where do churches and the right to religious freedom, where do those things fit into this?
Many governors have imposed limits on the number of people who can gather for religious worship. Governor Gavin Newsom has done that here in California. And churches have brought challenges that have gone to the Supreme Court. So far, governors' restrictions on religious worship have been upheld in the Supreme Court, and the churches have lost. There's one case brought by South Bay Pentecostal Church in the Los Angeles area, and went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled against the church. Chief Justice Roberts wrote an opinion that said just what I was uttering, that in the time of a pandemic, to stop the spread of communicable disease, the government can restrict liberty, including liberty for religious worship.
All right, so the government tries to impose restrictions, but then you have law enforcement officials, such as the L.A. County Sheriff's Department, headed up by Sheriff Alex Villanueva, who just said last week his officers, his deputies, will only enforce the new pandemic rules as, quote, an extreme last resort. I know LAPD doesn't seem to have any directive about enforcement as well. If the public health department then sets these restrictions, do the police agencies have to support those rules, or can they ignore them?
In practical reality, they can ignore them. There's always discretion on the part of the police of what to enforce. Going 1 mile over the speed limit would be a basis for a ticket, but thankfully, rarely do police enforce that. Possessing even the tiniest amount of marijuana still violates the Federal Controlled Substance Act, but federal law enforcement doesn't ever go about enforcing that law. So you need not only the health department to adopt the regulations, but also the police to decide they want to enforce them.
I'm pretty biased when it comes to the American way of life, that individual liberty is a good thing. Some countries with tighter government control, particularly in Asia, thinking China and Vietnam and even South Korea, they have been much more successful at limiting the spread of the virus. Dean Chemerinsky, is this pandemic an example of where the U.S. philosophy of government, based so strongly on individual rights, is actually a drawback?
I think it's important to stress that under the Constitution, the government has the power that's necessary to stop the spread of communicable disease. The question is, does the government want to exercise that power? And that's a political question. And what we've seen is the states that have decided not to exercise that power are seeing the worst explosion of cases. And states that have done more to impose shutdowns and exercise that power are seeing fewer cases. So it's not a question of constitutional authority. It's a question of whether the government wants to use that power.
Do you think there's a threat, perhaps, of government overreach? I mean, think about, during World War II, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in Honolulu, and, all of a sudden, Japanese internment camps started popping up. That was obviously an extreme government overreach. And by the way, I'm not equating something as serious and horrible as World War II to this pandemic. But I mean, you can see there are extreme examples of government overreach in a situation where the government can really take advantage of something like that.
I think there is a danger of government overreach. And you give a powerful example where the government abused its power with great human costs. On the other hand, no right is absolute. And it's always a question of what's reasonable under the circumstances. Interning Japanese Americans wasn't reasonable. My own view is requiring people to wear a mask in the time of a pandemic is reasonable and is a relatively minimal restriction on freedom.
So at the end of the day, is this a question about balance? I mean, the common good versus individual freedoms? Is that more of a question of ethics maybe than legality? Is it really something that we all have to decide for ourselves in a way to follow the rules or to, make sure that we're doing the right thing?
It's not a question of personal ethics. As I emphasize, the courts have said consistently that the government can take reasonable actions to stop the spread of communicable disease. The government can quarantine people. The government can order people to shelter in place. The government can order closure of restaurants and other businesses. The government can require that people wear masks. And those who try to challenge those restrictions in court consistently lose. Now, whether the government should take those actions is something that we can debate. And whether people in their own lives want to obey those restrictions is obviously individual. But if you want to talk about government power, the government can act so long as it's reasonable to stop the spread of COVID-19.
Erwin Chemerinsky, professor and dean of the law school over at UC Berkeley, an expert on constitutional law. Sir, thank you so much for being with us.
Truly my pleasure. Thank you.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, with so many restaurants closed, rodents, big ones, are also having to find other places to eat, which is causing infestations in other places. Exterminators are busier than ever. That's tomorrow on the show. We're online at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast, would you? Take Greater LA with you wherever you go. And of course, share your stories with us too. Tell us how you're doing. kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Kevin Tidmarsh, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Paul Smith, Mike Newport, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen today. I'm Steve Chaitakis, thanking you for your ears and for your time. Please, please stay safe and have a great night.